Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly analysis of major economic events and forces and trends in our society affecting our income, our jobs, our futures, the prices we pay, the debts we carry, the whole economic dimensions of our lives. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life at several universities. Currently, I teach in the graduate program for international affairs of the New School University in New York City. I also write regularly for The Guardian newspaper in Great Britain and for Truthout. Truthout is a remarkable institution that does daily news and analysis of a superb and independent quality. I urge you to check them out at truthout.org. For those of you interested in the kinds of analysis and discussions on these programs, please know that you can get much more of this at your leisure on either of the two websites that we maintain. The first one is rdwolf.com, and the second one is democracyatwork.info. Both of those websites have a great deal of material that we add to on a daily basis, and that is done in order to serve the interests of the public that this program reaches. Both of those websites also provide you with a way to talk to us with your questions, your comments, your criticisms, all of which are read each and every one. Many of them are responded to, and they help us to shape this program, the people we invite, such as our guests today, but also the topics we choose and how we treat them. So once again, if you're interested in this kind of material and or communicating to us, check out our websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Let me also ask you to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. As we turn to our updates, our short ones today, we need partly to return to some topics we've dealt with before. One of them is the ongoing saga that makes the news these days, which is the Obamacare or Affordable Care Act rollout, the provision for the people of the United States to comply with the law and to get more of Americans medically insured. As everyone, I'm sure, knows, the rollout has been complicated and difficult with all kinds of computer glitches and charges and countercharges, particularly between the Republicans and Democrats. I wanted to cut through a lot of that and make two points which have become clearer in the last week. The first point is that any program of this kind is complicated and difficult. We are a population of over 300 million people, and to provide a program that is designed to affect something as fundamental as medical insurance for all of us is inherently difficult. The second point is that all of the difficulties are made 1,000 times more difficult by one fundamental fact. That instead of providing medical care for our people, a fairly straightforward proposition, we're not really doing that. What we are doing is trying to provide more and better medical care than we already have, while obeying the requirements and the dictates of four private enterprise groups: the doctors, the hospitals, the provisioners, or the producers of drugs and medical equipment, and finally, the medical insurance companies. Each of these are organized as independent, private, profit-making businesses, and they all had a great deal to do with designing that law, changing that law, administering that law, fixing the whole process as it happens. And when they participate, the number one goal in each of them is to secure, maintain their profit-making position. And making profit is one thing, serving the medical needs of human beings is something else. And trying to put them together produces a mess. The single most important sign of that mess is the fact that here in the United States, we spend roughly 18% of our GDP, our total output of goods and services, on the medical side of life requirements. Most other advanced industrial countries spend less than half of that. Now, we wouldn't mind perhaps paying twice as much for medical care as anybody else if we got twice the medical quality results. We don't. The results in the United States, as measured in any of the standard ways, longevity, number of newborns that live through the first year, the number of days in the hospital when you're sick, whatever measure is used, the United States is mediocre, comes down halfway through. It's not the worst, it's not the best. So to get a mediocre result while paying twice as much as everybody else ought long ago to have raised the red flag that we can't raise in the United States because of the taboo on questioning a private profit-driven system. If you want to understand the difference, go to either a member of the Congress who gets free regular medical care without paying a nickel, or go to one of our veterans who is served by the VA hospital system, which also is a kind of single-payer situation where a veteran doesn't have to pay lots of money, gets a basic coverage, etc., etc. We know how to do it, and the only reason we don't have it is because we are impeded by a private profit-driven medical system. The next time you hear stories about how efficient capitalism is, keep in mind the mess that we make of medical care because of our slavishness towards a private profit system. Second update, or additional update today that I want to get to, has to do with a growing economic risk that all of us need to pay attention to. And the risk is called deflation. That is, it's the opposite of an inflation. It's a situation when prices in general drop. And typically when prices drop, wages drop with them. And a deflation is a kind of general decline in prices. Has that happened historically? Yes. Has it happened fairly often? Yes. What happens when you have a deflation? Well, if everybody's prices dropped along with their income, we might not mind because we'd get, 10% less income in our paycheck at the end of the week, but we'd have 10% less prices to pay, and it would sort of even out. The problem is there are things that don't adjust with a deflation, and one of the most important is your debt. Your debt is denominated in money. You owe X thousands of dollars on your home, on your car, on your child's college education, what have you. That debt is fixed. And if all your prices go down and your income goes down, the cost of your debt effectively goes up because you still have to come up with the same dollars even though your income has dropped along with other prices. In a society as heavily indebted as ours, and as indeed many other societies are, the growing phenomena of a deflation or a deflationary threat on the horizon, which is now big news in Europe, big news in Japan, and we ought to be considering it here too because, for example, durable goods have been dropping in price in the United States now for several years, and it will be a serious new set of problems if this deflation threat continues and is realized. What's the fundamental cause of falling prices and wages? Simple. It's an economic system in trouble. Too much unemployment, too many people without money to spend, forces businesses to lower prices or to be stuck with unsellable goods. And when businesses have to lower their prices, they press down on their wages, the workers' wages that they pay, and you get that deflationary spiral, which can be as dangerous as an inflationary one. And it is a sign of economic weakness, which is what we have taught in economics courses all my adult life, and therefore a sign that the so-called recovery is limp and lame at best. Next update has to do with interesting events that we can learn from the city of Madrid, Spain. As you know from this program, Spain is one of the countries worst hit by the current global economic crisis. The official unemployment rate in Spain, as I'm speaking to you, is over 25%. That's the rate it was at the height of the Great Depression of the 1930s here in the United States, 25%. Give you some idea of the level of economic suffering and dislocation in that major part of Europe. Not surprisingly, if you have 25% of your people out of work, those are people who cannot and do not pay income taxes, basically because they don't get any income. It's not a complicated idea. And if the federal government in Spain can't get the kind of income it did before, it's unable to spend the money that it used to spend on all the public services. So it should come as no surprise that eventually the federal government in Spain was unwilling to give as much money as it used to for taking care of garbage pickup in the city of Madrid, which is, after all, the major city in that country. So recently, they informed, that is, the government in Spain, the three large corporations that do most of the garbage pickup in Madrid, that they would be getting less funding for the work they do than they used to as part of the economic crisis that Spain, like all of Europe, is facing. The three companies responded in the way that you might expect in a capitalist economic system. Okay, they said, if you're not going to give us as much money before, here's what we're going to say to our workers. We're going to propose a new contract, now that the old one is expiring, in which you will get no increase in wages for the next several years, and we propose to lay off 1,134 of you out of a total of 6,000 workers who do the garbage work in Madrid. The union turned around and said, no, we will not accept that. And so a garbage strike began early this month, in November, in Spain. And it was astounding. Mountains of garbage arose in the city of Madrid, a serious problem not only for the population of Madrid, but Madrid is a major tourist destination for all of Europe, and it meant that the tourists visiting had to climb over mountains of garbage to get in and out of their hotels, to get in and out of the museums, and so on. It was an untenable arrangement. And so finally an agreement was reached, a settlement, in which the union fought hard and won the following. And I think it's interesting, particularly for unions in other parts of the world. There would be no layoffs. I can't get the information on exactly what the wage settlement was. They may have accepted the wage freeze, but they won a no-layoff clause so that no workers would lose their jobs. In exchange, the union arranged and accepted the following. Every worker of all of those who would not be laid off and all of those who weren't in question, all 6,000, agreed to take 6 weeks off without pay every year between now and 2017. I want to stress that. On the one hand, the union is accepting something difficult. Those workers are going to lose 6 weeks of pay, which is no minor matter out of a 52-week. That's 10% of the year's income. On the other hand, it is a way of sharing unemployment. It's a different way of understanding what unemployment means. If you can't pay all the workers, you don't select a small subset and really destroy them by losing everything, losing their job. Instead, the unemployment is shared. And that means all workers have an interest in fighting these conditions, since all workers have to share in the unemployment that an employer is threatening them with. But of course, one might wish that the union had gone a little further. And one direction it might have gone in, and that's why we do this kind of study a little differently than other radio and television programs, is they might have said, gee, one way to handle less money from the government is to do away with the category of profit. We don't need a big company earning a fat profit doing the garbage cleanup. Suppose the union workers, with their union, approached the government and said, we'll do the garbage work as a workers' cooperative. Pay us what you want, and the money that you save, the less money you give us, will be money that we don't provide as profits to a large corporation. We'll just use it to provide what we most want, garbage cleanup on the one hand and jobs and income for the workers on the other. That could have been a part of the conversation, and it should have been, but it wasn't, and maybe that's something we can contribute. Finally, I want to make a brief comment about a major deal that was struck in this last week between the United States government on the one hand and J.P. Morgan Chase, one of the largest banks in the United States. It has gotten a great deal of attention because the bank agreed to pay $13.5 billion, that's a lot of money, more than these settlements have been in the past with other banks, just for one part of the kind of business that it conducted in a way that the government found either illegal or unethical or both. and it was the mortgage business. It was all the work that the J.P. Morgan Chase did and its two subsidiaries that it bought, Bear Stearns on the one hand and the Washington Mutual Savings and Loan Company on the other. So for their mortgage dealings, they had to come up with $13 billion. And it sounds like a tremendous fine and a tremendous punishment. It's important to understand that it isn't, nor is it a major help to all the people hurt by what that bank and others like it did. Let me explain. The total amount of mortgage writing in the 10 or so years before the crisis hit in 2008, done by J.P. Morgan Chase, Bear Stearns, and Washington Mutual, is estimated in the New York Times of November 21st to be around $1 trillion. Well, if you do $1 trillion worth of mortgage business, and the fine you have to pay when all the dust clears is $13 billion, that works out to 1.3% of your business. Not exactly the kind of fine that would bring you up short and make you rethink the way you do business. It's a small amount of money, however big it looks in the headlines. Number two, only $4 billion out of the $13 billion that J.P. Morgan Chase has to pay is earmarked for homeowners who lost their homes through foreclosure or to face foreclosure. Well, folks, let's be honest. There are millions and millions of people in the United States, over 4 million who've already been foreclosed out of their homes, and many millions more that are facing the risk of foreclosure because they are more or less behind on their mortgage payments. $4 billion stretched over 4 to 10 million people works out to less than $1,000 per family. That's not going to make any difference to losing your home, facing an unbearable and intolerable mortgage. So the portion of this that goes to the homeowner cannot and will not solve the problem that we have in the United States today, which is a record number of empty houses sitting across the street from a record number of families who have no place to live. Okay, so much for our updates. I want to turn now and welcome our guest. Very pleased to have with us today Professor Sheila D. Collins. Welcome.
Thank you.
I want to introduce her to all of you. She's a professor of political science emerita at William Patterson University and a former director of its graduate program in public policy and international affairs. She's also a co-founder and board member of the well-known National Jobs for All Coalition. She's authored or co-authored many books and articles, encyclopedia entries on a range of subjects, including public policy, political economy, social movements, environmental ethics, and so on. I invited her today because I want to talk about a remarkable new book just out that she co-edited with her colleague, Gertrude Goldberg. I believe it's due for release in 2014,
It's already out. This week, yeah.
Good. From Oxford University Press.
Right.
Wonderful. It's called, let me get the title correctly.
When Government Helped.
There it is. Well, thank you very much. When Government Helped. And it really is a marvelous study of what happened in the Great Depression, what happened under the Roosevelt era, and what it implies about what is not happening today. And I want very much to get right into it and start. So let me begin by posing the basic question, at least as I see it. During the New Deal, under Roosevelt, you could describe many of the major policy initiatives, the creation of Social Security, the creation of the unemployment compensation system, the wonderful federal jobs program that put so many otherwise unemployed people to work. You could call that bottom-up economics. It's helping people at the bottom who need it the most and thinking that if you help them, give them a job, give them an income, give them support, they will then spend that money creating more demand for goods and services. It's a bottom-up approach rather than relying on helping the banks and corporations at the top and hoping it trickles down. Okay. Tell me, is that a reasonable way to describe the situation as the difference between then and now?
Yes, absolutely. It really, because what's happening now, it's a top-down approach. All of the resources are going to bail out the people at the top end of the economic ladder, whereas the resources of the Roosevelt administration, for the most part, went to bail out the people who were really suffering from the Depression, homeowners who had been foreclosed on, as you said, unemployed workers, the poor, et cetera.
Tell me, is there some shorthand way to understand why? Why was bottom-up the policy then, and why is that absent now?
Right. Well, there are actually several reasons for that, Rick. For one thing, the New Dealers had grown up in the Progressive Era, which was focused on the good that government could do in reforming society. So they had been imbued with this kind of value system. Second was Roosevelt.
So the government, if I could interrupt, so it wasn't like in our case, I guess that's your point. It wasn't preceded by an era in which government was bad-mouthed
and government
was made the evil demon.
Right.
It was the opposite, that government could and would help.
Right. Okay. And at that time in history, people had very little experience of a large federal government. There was no large federal government until Roosevelt. So they had no, you know, inbuilt as much animosity as they do today after a 40-year propaganda campaign by the right to discredit government. Secondly, was Roosevelt's own concern for the forgotten man, and possibly coming out of his own experience, but possibly also because of his own vulnerability as a result of having had polio. He was sensitized to the suffering of people to an extent that our current policymakers aren't at all. thirdly, many of the New Dealers he appointed to his administration had had early experiences working in settlement houses in the urban centers, and therefore had developed a feeling for what poverty and unemployment did to people on a human level. And so they approached their work from kind of a social work perspective rather than from an economically technical perspective. They wanted to restore dignity to the worker. Which we don't hear about today. All we hear about is reviving economic growth rather than what we can do for the human being. The third was, or fourth, I can't remember where I am in this list, was the fact that the top-down approach under Hoover had failed, obviously. We were nearly 4 years into the Depression, and people were desperate. There were militant social movements in the street demanding that the government respond to their needs in the way that there wasn't in 2008.
Right.
And so that pressure on the government, the desperate condition of people played a role. Then you had the funding for all these programs was to a large extent from the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which was an independent government entity which had been created by Hoover, actually. But when he used
the power,
he sent the money to banks and insurance companies like we're doing today. When Roosevelt took over, he continued the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, but used it to fund programs for the poor and unemployed.
Can I pick up on this?
Yeah.
There's something that's extraordinarily interesting to me, and that's to pick up, even though you made a list and all of them are important, clearly, and persuasive.
And there's even more.
And I'm sure there are more. But I want to pick up on one that's important for me. The social movements that were pushing from below and making a demand, with the exception of the Occupy Wall Street movement, which was that, but which came late and has not lasted a long time, at least for the moment, or is in a low ebb at this moment compared to what it was at the end of 2011. With accepting that, and it's an important exception, I don't mean to be disrespectful to it, but with the exception of that, we don't have anything like the combined pressure of the Communist parties, the Socialist parties, and above all, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO. Is that your sense also? And could you tell us a little more about the importance of that organization of the working class from below and its role in what Roosevelt did?
Right. Well, exactly. Where you have organized political parties and trained cadre who can go out into the streets and into the workplaces and know how to organize people and create the kind of propaganda and message to, that ordinary people can understand, you get much further. Now, another important part of that story, however, is that Roosevelt, unlike Hoover, refused to use police violence against the social movements. And so, and
was
unlike
that a policy, basically?
Yes, yeah. He did. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And unlike today, where the Occupy movement was severely crushed and probably from a coordinated national, you know,
certainly looked
perspective,
like it,
it looked like it. Yeah. Uh-huh. So it allowed the social movements to grow and to continue to put pressure on the administration. And there was a real fear during that time. There was also were also movements of the right, the fascist movements. But there was a real fear at that time among the political elite that if government didn't respond, we might have either a revolution of the right or the left.
So that was a powerful lever on the situation.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Okay. One of the things that I clearly struck you and Gertrude Goldberg, your co-editor, and also struck me is the fact that much of the focus, or at least a significant part of the focus of the programs of bottom-up helping people, mm-hmm. had an environmental or ecological dimension. Tell us a little bit about what that was, because many people think that that's a new awareness that's recent, mm-hmm. but you show in your work that it was already present there, and that the notion of combating unemployment and helping the environment could be combined. How did that work out?
It's really astounding to me, Rick, that neither historians of the New Deal nor environmental historians have really picked up on that dimension of the Great Depression and New Deal, with the exception of a few. Roosevelt himself, I think he was a much greater and more modern and more prescient ecologist than Teddy Roosevelt, whom everybody sees as the environmental president. But if you read Roosevelt's speeches, it's really, he was an amazing ecological scientist in some respects. He had grown up in Hyde Park. As a boy, he had studied all the flora and fauna of the estate. He had kept careful scientific records of it. And so when he came into the presidency, as Schlesinger said, he had a visceral feeling for what was happening to the environment. And he felt it as a personal grief or a personal tragedy. We also underrate the enormity of the environmental crisis of the 1930s. In passing, we talk about the Dust Bowl, but there were many other environmental crises as well. 7/8 of the original forests had been decimated by the time the Depression arrived. 1/6 of the entire nation's topsoil was about to blow away in the Dust Bowl. Much of the wildlife had been destroyed. I mean, industrialization was really destroying the country. And so Roosevelt saw the opportunity to both employ unemployed young people by putting in and conserve and restore, save the environment by putting young people to work in the Civilian Conservation Corps that also employed, by the way, World War I veterans and Native Americans. But
what kind of things did they do? Can you give us a feeling for that?
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, the CCC reforested the country. I mean, we might be in a different place today in terms of climate change and species distinction had it not been for the CCC, reforesting the country, restoring wildlife, building a truly national system of parks, county, state, local parks, and refurbishing the national park system. They taught farmers through the Soil Conservation Service how to conserve the soil, how to grow crops in an ecologically, you know,
conservative
way.
We nowadays call sustainability.
Sustainable way, exactly. The TVA was another program that Roosevelt... Tennessee Valley Authority, which basically brought an entire region of the country, parts of 7 states and all of Tennessee, into the 20th century. It had really been the U.S.'s third world. A third of the population suffered from malaria, hookworm, pellagra, I mean, you name it. People were dirt poor. In the cold country, they used kerosene to heat their homes.
So really, across the board, if I'm understanding you right, Roosevelt figured out how to combine a bottom-up economic revival program with a environmentally sensitive program for ecological sustainability. It's really
exactly.
a model. So when
it's
people
really
today
a model.
Say
mm-hmm.
they want a Green New Deal, the irony is the New Deal was green.
Right. And hardly anybody who talks about a Green New Deal refers back to this model. This is what is astounding to me.
Yes, a very important point. Okay, we're going to take our usual mid-program break now. I want to remind you all, I am going to be coming back with my guest, Sheila Collins, who together with Gertrude Goldberg has just released with Oxford University Press a new book called When Government Helped, Learning from the Successes and Failures of the New Deal. So stay with us. We'll be back in a few seconds to continue this conversation on Economic Update. Folks, welcome back to Economic Update. This is Richard Wolff. My guest is Sheila D. Collins, co-editor of this book, which I'm here showing to those of us who can see us on television. It's a brand new book, When Government Helped, Learning from the Successes and Failures of the New Deal, just out by Oxford University Press. Let me recommend it to you as a wonderful collection of essays that will make you understand not only what happened in the last time capitalism collapsed in the United States, but give you a clear understanding of what is happening now in relationship to what could be happening and isn't happening, and that's just as important to help understand the current situation as anything else. In your book, and in several of the essays, you refer to the New Deal as having gotten interrupted at the very least, if not deflected, by what you call a deficit phobia, a shift of opinion in Washington and elsewhere that the problem wasn't, as it might appear to be, people losing their homes, people without work, industries not functioning, but instead was government debt, and that had to be problem number one. Could you tell us about this, what you call deficit phobia, how it worked then, and how it shapes what is happening now?
Okay. Yeah, I think the concern about deficits was an orthodox economic kind of belief system, ideology, if you will, in the 1930s, which Roosevelt and many of his administration believed in. But Roosevelt, for a time, was willing to go into deficit financing under the threat of the emergency. Now, in 1937, there was a kind of a euphoria built that the economy was recovering, and therefore we no longer needed to engage in deficit financing. Mariner Eccles, who was the head of the Federal Reserve, thought it was not the time to stop deficit financing, but he was overruled by Henry Morgenthau, who had a really obsession about deficits that one historian attributes perhaps to his own insecurities. He wasn't an economist. He didn't really know much about the, you know, how economics works. But he really pushed Roosevelt, and Roosevelt himself, of course, you know, thought deficits were the wrong kind of policy. So in 1937, Roosevelt began to cut back on federal financing, and the economy tanked very quickly into even the figures were even stronger than the 29 crash. So Roosevelt learned from that experience, I think, that he had to quickly put money back into people's pockets, into Main Street, and did. But it didn't pick up enough to end the Depression. And it was really the experience of hyper-fiscal policy during World War II, hyper-deficit spending, that convinced, I think, Roosevelt and the members of the New Deal that we should not do this again. But of course, after the war and with Roosevelt's death, the reactionary forces of the right came back, and so we had built up, you know, over the years, the idea that although not right away, but this whole deficit phobia today, I think, is, and also I forgot to mention that in 1937 there was also a real fear of inflation, and so they felt they had to cut back on spending. Today you have a deficit phobia with no fear of inflation. I mean, inflation is relatively nil.
That's why so I stressed at the beginning that deflation, if anything,
right, is on the real horizon. Problem. Yeah. So I think that the economic elites really want to cut federal spending for people at the bottom because they fear that that cuts into their own profits, and they don't want to, you know, have to pay higher taxes for the government to pay back their debts. I mean, it's an absolutely crazy phobia, and it's really destroying our way of life, our system, and our democracy.
I think it's a stunning thing that the very words you use, we have not seen anything other than a deficit phobia, except at the very beginning, when the economy really looked, particularly in the last half of 2008, like it was going to be a total collapse. Right. At that moment, from President Bush on to the new President Obama, both of them, and the Congress fell all over themselves to spend the money that the government didn't have, to borrow and run the huge deficits, to bail out the banks, bail out General Motors, buy the American International Group Insurance Company. Nobody then, in those heady months of desperate action, nobody worried about a deficit.
Right.
It's literally like, you know, when the cows are out of the barn, then you're going to close. Suddenly, you're concerned about a deficit when the thing is to help the mass of people. Having just finished bailing out at enormous public expense the people at the top. So the deficit phobia is a very selectively implied and applied policy.
Yes.
Okay, I want to draw you out on something that is of enormous interest to me, and I'd like your opinion about it. After World War II, as we all know, there was a systematic attack and destruction of all the forces that had pushed the bottom-up approach in the Great Depression. The communists were demonized and made into agents of a foreign power. Socialists were more or less equated with communists and tarred with the same brush. And the attack on the labor movement, starting with the Taft-Hartley bill late in the 40s and continuing to the present day, has weakened the labor movement. As everyone knows, it's been on a 50-year decline. Is it reasonable, this is really your judgment I'm interested in, is it reasonable to see the post-World War II destruction of the organization from below as a response to what was achieved by that organization during the 1930s through the New Deal? Mm-hmm. Is that a reasonable historical inference?
I think it is, absolutely. I think there's been a very conscious effort to destroy the New Deal coalition, as it's been called. Now, it really didn't start. It didn't start after World War II. It started perhaps in 1938 with the House Un-American Activities Committee and the pullback of the Southern Democrats from support of the National Labor Relations Act. But it built through the war. And into the, and then the next resurgence was, of course, the anti-communism of the 50s, and then the
McCarthyism,
and then the 1970s. So it was a key turning point.
Tell us about that.
Business had been active, in trying to destroy labor from early on. But during the 1970s, when the deindustrialization was happening and the international economy was changing dramatically, business saw an opportunity to, and because of the 1960s, because business had been so derided by the social movements of the 1960s, and they saw the country heading back in the direction of, you know, the New Deal, they decided to go on the offensive. And they held high-level meetings. There was a famous memo that went out,
Powell memo saying
that we have to get the agenda back on track, we have to promote laissez-faire, we have to discredit unionism, et cetera. And so they created all kinds of think tanks and research institutes and legal institutions to take back the ideology of the country from one that was moving in the wrong direction.
And in a sense, what we call Reaganism, or in Europe, Thatcherism,
right,
or neoliberalism, really are all parts of this process you're describing.
Yes. It was a very conscious campaign, very conscious. And in fact, I got a hold of some papers back in the 1980, right when Reagan was elected, that had been taken out of a conservative caucus briefing by a conservative member, a member of a conservative foundation who had attended this meeting. And she was so upset at what she heard going on, and which was an orchestrated campaign to target specific sectors of the population with specific kinds of propaganda campaigns, educational efforts, et cetera. She was so upset that she came back and spread this message around the liberal philanthropic community, and called it fascism. I mean, this was from a, you know, very conservative foundation member. So I think, and we've seen what's happened since, Citizens United, you know, a whole raft of sending civil rights legislation back to the states, and on and on.
So in an important way, as your book, I think, also shows, what we are living through today, both the collapse of this economic system in the manner of the Great Depression, again, I believe we currently still call it the Great Recession, because it isn't quite as bad yet as it was, but that much of what's going on now is illuminated and shown for what it means precisely by the historical exercise of your book in making a systematic comparison that can get us clear about what has to be learned from the last time it broke down.
Right. You know, Gore Vidal once said, we live in the United States of amnesia. We don't know our history, and we don't, therefore, learn from history. And so we did this book because we felt this history was so important for Americans to understand, as a way of understanding the current period.
Good.
And hopefully making changes, you know, based on that learning.
Folks, let me conclude. I want to thank Sheila Collins for coming and talking with us. Again, this is a remarkable book just out, When Government Helped, Learning from the Successes and the Failures of the New Deal. Collins and Goldberg, Oxford University Press. I really think it's a way to get depth and historical background to very much the things we do on this program. Thank you very, very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Rick, for having me.
In our remaining time today, I want to respond, as usual, to your questions, and quickly, because we have so many of them, and I can't, as I always have to apologize, I can't do justice to all of them, but please keep them coming because they shape our program. First question, are we at risk of losing our unemployment benefits? Well, it's a very important question. And indeed, under the current arrangements, it is expected that Congress, because of the divisions between the Republicans and Democrats, even though those divisions are about other topics like health care and Benghazi and the wars and so forth, it is expected that they will not extend, as the Obama administration has requested, unemployment compensation benefits to be extended for another year. There are estimates ranging from 2 million to 4 million Americans will therefore no longer get benefits if the extension is indeed not forthcoming, as is the expectation. What that means, and look at the logical way this can be understood in terms of what Professor Collins just told us, here is an example not only of not doing bottom up, but of literally cutting the benefits to those at the bottom as a way of so-called adjustment of the government's finances with this deficit phobia. An extraordinary step to be taken. Next question has to do with, is it indeed the case that we cannot afford as a nation to tax rich people, because if we do, somehow they will retaliate and we'll all be worse off? An argument that comes to us in this program literally every week. So I thought the following was an interesting bit of news to pass on to you, and I'm grateful here for the Too Much journal that comes out of Washington. You can find it at Too Much Online. It's a wonderful regular weekly documentation of economics, and I'm looking at the November 18th edition, and here's what it tells us. During the 2012 elections, voters in California opted to raise the tax rates on the state's highest incomes. The vote, which was successful, left California's deep pockets with a 13.3% tax rate on income over $1 million. That is the nation's highest state tax rate. Opponents in California threatened that such a tax-the-rich approach would force a massive exodus of California's wealthy people who would leave the state. So here we are, a good year or so afterwards. What's the reality? Well, a new report from California says that it has experienced the nation's, ready, largest increase in residents worth over $30 million. Not only was the threat empty, but the exact opposite happened. More revenue for the state of California, less need to cut back on its people's services, because there are more rich people to pay the higher tax, not less. As Kevin Rose in New York Magazine said with his tongue in his cheek, either the super rich are crying wolf when they flee or vow to flee higher taxes, or else, clever remark, they take a very long time to pack. Okay. Now a bit more interesting comments that I can answer this week in a way I couldn't a week ago because of elections. The question was, can a socialist ever again win elective office in the United States, or is the job that's been done on the American people so complete that no socialist can ever win? How interesting that that question should have come literally 3 days before a young woman economics professor in Seattle, Washington, did exactly that, running on an explicitly socialist platform for a socialist party. Chama Sawant, I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly, won a seat on the city council of Seattle, Washington. As a socialist candidate, defeating a longtime Democratic Party incumbent who had held that seat. Among the things she demanded were $15 hour minimum wage, precisely what the movements of Walmart workers and McDonald's workers are demanding for low paid minimum wage, retail and fast food types of workers, and a tax on millionaires to sustain public transportation, an important issue in the Seattle area, and other public services. So a classical kind of socialist program wins an election, defeating both Republicans and Democrats. So to the question, is that possible in the United States? The answer is, you bet. Another question. Do the Republicans have a complete edge on raising money because of the Citizens United ruling that allows wealthy people and corporations to give virtually unlimited amounts of money to these super PACs who don't exactly support this or that candidate but can spend an awful lot of money with negative and positive ads. Is that something that the Republicans have overwhelmingly and that will guarantee a Republican versus a Democrat future? Well, this is a course in economics, so I am interested in the role of money in politics as I am interested in anything else. And so what caught my eye was a story in Time magazine of November 25th, 2013, which makes an interesting point with documentation. You might think that the Republicans were ahead because in 2010, for example, they were. In this kind of what's often called dark money, I love the words, Republicans raised $211 million in 2010. The Liberals and Democrats raised $211 million and Republicans $266 million. So clearly the Republicans did better. By 2012, the Republicans really did better. They raised and spent $860 million on that election compared to the Democrats' $406. In other words, Republicans were outspending Democrats better than 2-1 in these races, and that shaped the outcome. You may recall that in those years, Republicans defeated Democrats handily. But how interesting and how quickly the world changes. In 2013, the Democrats caught up and surpassed the Republicans. And indeed, they're on tap to do that again in 2014. The Democrats, understanding what was happening to them, being defeated, and by understanding I mean, to make sure everybody understands what I'm saying, that money makes the difference to who wins the election. Is it the only thing that makes the difference? No. Can you sometimes defeat the money? Yes. But election for election, over the time, statistically, having more money is an enormous advantage. And the Democrats did not want to lose all that they can have at stake in losing elections. So they're now raising the kinds of money that the Republicans once did. So they're both kind of neck and neck. The Democrats are a little bit ahead these days. We're over the $1 billion mark in this amount of money. And I thought that the article in Time magazine gave some wonderful examples that you might not know of among Democrats and Republicans. For example, New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg and California environmental activist Tom Steyer spent millions targeting Virginia Republican gubernatorial candidate Ken Cuccinelli's gun control and climate change policies. He was defeated, and the Democrats are set to sweep the entire election race in Virginia, which used to be a state that they could not touch. So basically, we now have the billionaires on both sides of the major parties, and while they disagree on some things like gun control and climate, when it comes to the basic support of this economic system, no matter how poorly it functions for the mass of people, they don't seem to have a big disagreement, which maybe helps explain why so few candidates are doing what Professor Sawant in Seattle showed was possible. And not to forget, the rumors are now spreading more and more. I don't know if it's true, but that Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, is apparently seriously considering a run for the presidency. He is a member of the U.S. Senate, and I believe the only person there for whom the label socialist is not rejected by him outright. Capitalism is having a hard time. It's no one's fault but its own. It has collapsed now twice in the last 75 years. Our guest today gave us important insights into what was done in the 1930s, its first big collapse. We are now living through the second big collapse. If it weren't for ideological blinders, we would long ago have begun a national discussion about what it means to have a system that works in this way, breaks down twice, produces the kinds of inequalities we're living with, etc. Last point. Steve from Brooklyn. wanted to know when it will be possible for us to break, for those of us who care about it, the notion that an anti-capitalism, a socialist alternative of one kind or another, is necessarily going to lead to or is the same as totalitarianism, dictatorship, and things like that. Part of us has to be honest and say, yeah, some socialist experiments ended up there, and that's a serious problem that has to be admitted and it has to be faced. But we also have to remember what is so conveniently often forgotten, that capitalist economic system also often ends in dictatorship and authoritarian. The economy of Saudi Arabia today, which excludes most people from meaningful participation in anything remotely like democracy, proudly calls itself capitalist. The apartheid regime in South Africa proudly called itself and was capitalist. Pinochet's Chile was capitalist. Today's Russia proclaims that despite the obvious dictatorship of Putin and the others, it is a capitalist country, no longer what it once was. So capitalism, too, can take authoritarian and dictatorship forms. The bottom line, economic system is one thing. The need to fight for and preserve democratic, non-authoritarian government is also something that has to be on the agenda. And indeed, one of the reasons we on this program spend the time we do talking about an alternative to capitalist organizations of enterprises, democratizing the enterprise, making the enterprise itself something in the manner of a co-op that is run democratically, is because if you made the most important institution producing goods and services run in a democratic way, that might end up being the best guarantee you have for a counterweight to any tendency anywhere towards dictatorship and totalitarianism. Thank you again for all your comments, your questions, your interest. I hope you found the comments of my guest, Sheila Collins, worthwhile. Please take a look at her book. This is Richard Wolff, Economic Update. And remember, please, to check out our websites, rdwolff.com, democracyatwork.info, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. And I look forward to being with you and talking with you again next week.